This November, we head to the polls and select the 45th President of the United States of America. But today, Cards Against Humanity is asking you to vote with your dollar for the candidate that you support. The Democratic nominee, Hillary Clinton, is a graduate of Yale Law School who has served our country as Secretary of State, Senator from New York, and First Lady of the United States. In her decades of public service, she has tirelessly advocated for women's rights, campaign finance reform, and access to health care. The Republican candidate, Donald Trump, will make America great again. He is a powerful CEO who wears three suits at once. All across America, buildings scream his name. Trump! Trump! He always knows what time it is. Donald Trump is a huge man who lives in a golf course. At the end of this promotion, Cards Against Humanity will tally up the sales of both packs, and depending on which pack gets more support, we will donate all the money in support of Hillary Clinton. Exercise your sacred franchise at www.americavotes with cardsagainsthumanity.com.
Here I am in my good microphone.
Ooh, that sounds good. You sound great this week.
The secret is not getting enough sleep and then waking up immediately before the podcast.
What's your sleep situation been like lately?
Generally speaking, okay, but a combination of a deadline, like a writing deadline, and giving No Man's Sky a try has.
Haven't gotten into the No Man's Sky yet. Please don't tell me that it's really good and I need to spend a lot of time on it.
I would happily talk about it. I rarely get into a new game these days.
Explain No Man's Sky to me. Sell me on it.
Well, you know, it's normally the sort of game that I like is kind of a narrative game where I'm going to be able to interact with people socially, you know, and have good conversations and stuff like that. You know, kind of, you know, like the old original Fallouts or Planescape or even Fallout New Vegas was a pretty good example of that. You know, and there are exceptions. There are other kinds of games that I like Portal, you know, was great and stuff like that. But this game was pitched as, you know, procedurally generated entire universe where there are I think the number they threw out was a quintillion planets. You know, so much that if you played this game
now,
for your entire...
is it procedurally generated, meaning it's different for everyone, or is it like one universe that everyone's in?
It's different for everyone.
Okay.
So your
No Man's Sky is different than my No Man's Sky.
Exactly. Okay. Or at least, yeah, that's what I'm virtually certain of. And I'm sure that there's similarities because, you know, but yeah, they are each unique and each person plays in their own universe. And there's all these planets and, you know, and I took a crack at it because I'd put in a real good day of writing on Friday. And then I'm like, well, the kids are in bed and I've heard things about this game and it just came out. And I also happen to have $60. So why
this
not?
Is dangerous thinking.
You know, it's extremely dangerous for a person like me. Because I have, like, I don't know if I technically have, what do they call it, addictive personality disorder, but, you know, it's hard for me to like something a little bit. I either like it and I want to do it all the time forever until I die, or I'm not that interested. But I played it a lot. I played it a lot, and I live streamed it. And normally, when I was playing Fallout, you know, I live stream.
Let me stop you here because I feel like this is going to be confusing to some of our listeners. What is it when you live stream a game? You're playing the game.
That's true. I suppose that is kind of a
it's a
newer
thing. You know what's funny
it?
About live streaming is, like, I mean, you and I both know what it is, but to anyone who's not within sort of gaming culture, it sounds insane.
It really does. Well, it sounds
impossible that people would watch a live stream of a video game.
It sounds impossible until you stop to think about it, because, you know, what a live stream is somebody plays a game and then other people log onto their computers and watch you play the game and listen to you talk about it, you know, and stuff like that. And you're right. It does sound insane. And when I first heard about it, I'm like, this is the end times.
It's just so pathetic. But, it's like you can't even go to the trouble of playing the game yourself. You have to watch someone else play the game.
See, and that would not be an unreasonable thing to think. And I thought something very similar. I thought, you know, live streaming, here it is, the fifth horseman of the apocalypse. This is the sign of our decaying culture. But then I thought back to when I came home, like in between my 2 years of my master's degree, I came back to Stevens Point. I lived with some of my old college friends. And one of my very best friends, Ian, who was, you know, a couple years younger than me, he was playing Crazy Taxi. And he was really good at playing Crazy Taxi, and I was not. And I watched him play Crazy Taxi, I bet you, for 40 hours. You know, because he would play Crazy Taxi and I would sit on the couch and talk with him and watch him play Crazy Taxi, maybe give some advice and or encouragement, or just I liked watching him play Crazy Taxi. And there's been other games, too. I actually really enjoy watching people play games. It's kind of social. You hang out with your friends. And we all used to do that. And here I'm going to really date myself. You know, back when Ocarina of Time came out.
For me, it was Star Fox 64. And you'd show, everyone would know like a few of the secrets of how to get to right. some of the levels. Yeah.
Right. And so, you know, or hell, I can go all the way back to the original Mario Brothers. Like, me and my sister would play. And there, admittedly, it was sort of like you were keeping an eye on them. So when they died, you would get your turn. But it quickly became apparent that my sister was way better at playing this game than I was, but I was better at remembering which way to go. And so we beat the game together, her playing and me watching and kind of, you know, helping her navigate the maze. So anyway, you know, I you know, when I started live streaming very recently, and I don't do it frequently, but I did it for the charity. When I live streamed Fallout, and it was mostly a series of live streams where I continuously complained about the narrative structure of the game. It was pretty much one consistent, endless howling bitch.
a quick divergence on that Fallout 4. So this is a nice callback to an episode from, like, I'm gonna say like almost a year ago, where I was saying, well, when did Fallout 4 come out? It was like over New Year's almost, right?
No, it came out the day we launched the fundraiser. So it was in November.
We're not too far out from a year after this. I was saying that I really want to play Fallout. It's completely unacceptable to me to play Fallout on any sort of platform that's not a PC. Like, if it's, you know, if it's Fallout, if it's a shooter, if it's got that gameplay, like, I'm strictly a mouse and keyboard guy.
Agreed.
And I felt like at this stage in my life, I was not, you know, I've played some games on boot camp on my Mac, but it's not like great because it takes a while to, like, you have to quit everything on your computer and close it down and restart, and it's sort of like a lot of friction just to like start playing a game, as opposed to, you know, if you have a dedicated gaming PC, you can just turn it on and start playing. And I felt like I didn't want to just like buy a PC to play games on. I felt like I needed to make the PC. Like, it was some sort of like the same way that Thoreau had to like build his cabin. Like, I felt like there was some part of my like manhood was at stake, or I don't know, just my like, it was some part of my like essential humanness that I was like, I must construct this machine that's going to sustain me as I play games. And it took me from November until like 3 weeks ago to build the
PC.
Oh,
really?
Yeah, I mean, I sort of went down the rabbit hole. People sent very good resources. I'm not going to spend too much time on this, but people sent incredible resources from the podcast, and it had the effect. I mean, the PC gaming community is insane. I mean, there is way too much information out there. And it took me a long... I was really paralyzed because you get into these... you get to the point where you're doing something that's going to make a half a percentage difference in the performance, and you're agonizing over, do I spend the money on this or that or whatever? So anyway, we wound up with an intern over the summer who was like really handy with PCs and built gaming PCs with his friends. And I was like, could you just help walk me through this? So we went on a website called, I'll put all this in the show notes. We went on a website called Rational Increments. I'm just double checking that that is correct. Sorry, it's called Logical Increments. This is an amazing resource if anyone ever wants to build a PC. Basically, they group PCs into price tiers. There's about maybe over a dozen price tiers ranging from destitute on the bottom to monstrous on the top. I did not go for the top. I went a couple of tiers down. I built an enthusiast level gaming PC with a price tag of over $1,000, but under $2,000. And basically, they show you for each of these price tiers, if you depending on what components you select, how different games will look. And I actually, because I was so excited to play Fallout 4, I use the Fallout 4 like benchmarks, and it shows you like, well, if you buy this graphics card, you can turn these settings up, right? And then here's what the game will look like with and without it. So you can see the practical result of like, is it worth spending the extra $100 on this CPU or whatever? So I wound up building this truly bonkers gaming PC. It is huge. It is the size of, it is bigger than the luggage that I take to conventions. It's this like open air display case with like an acrylic front. So it's really beautiful and you can see right into it and see what's going on. Liquid cooled naturally. And I did get the, that new, GTX 1080 graphics card. I think I got the last one in the United States of America. So it's a very powerful gaming rig. I built it. I played 45 minutes of Fallout 4. I found it insufferable, yep. Awful, terrible. And so I just played Overwatch ever since.
It's really, I can't tell you the degree to which I'm reassured by the fact that you didn't like Fallout 4.
I found it utterly joyless.
Yeah. It's, well, and now here's, this might be like one of the fundamental differences between the two of us, though, right? Because you stopped playing.
For me, I think where you went down the that addictive path of Fallout 4, I am currently spiraling out in Overwatch to the point of like, it's like, it's basically all I want to do. I don't even want to be talking to you right now. I just want to be playing Overwatch. Like, it's that. So, and what's funny also is I did build an over $1,000 gaming PC to play a game that could run on a potato.
So I thought Overwatch, now are we talking about the same, it's the new Blizzard game, right?
It's the, so Overwatch, I'll just pretend that there's some listeners who don't know exactly what we're talking about when we get extremely nerdy about the gaming stuff. Overwatch is a new game. It's by Blizzard. It is a genre of game that is well established, and it is a team shooter. So basically what that means, it's a first person shooter, meaning, you know, you're sort of the, have the classic view of like you're looking out and you see your hands and your gun and you're shooting stuff in front of you. But rather than just running around and shooting monsters, like in most first person shooters, and there's sort of a story in a campaign, you're on a team with six people and you're trying to beat the other team of six people. And what's fun about Overwatch, and you know, again, they didn't invent this, they just sort of perfected it, is you're not just battling each other, you're completing an objective. So each team is trying, they're battling over a control point, so it's sort of like almost like a capture the flag mechanic. There's some maps where you're moving a payload from one side of the map to the other, and the other team is trying to stop you. And then it's always like you play one round on offense and one round on defense. And it is something about the number, there's like 20 characters, and each of them is highly simple, very simple and highly specific. So something about the variety of play styles that are available and the way that they strategically interact with each other and the camaraderie and the teamwork of doing these fun strategies with your teams. And out, there's like, you can sort of be a good tactician and like out battle people, like click your mouse better than the other person and kill them that way. Or there's the way I like to play, which is like you can out strategize them, where it's like if you think a few steps ahead, you know where they're going to go and you can set up behind them and surprise them and you know, flank them and kill their whole team.
you might want to dial back the technical level of advice you're giving, Max, with the whole you clicking the mouse better than them. That's
I know there's a lot of technical terms in here, so I don't want to put people off. I mean,
I don't think they are the game that really gets its hooks into me, but you know, it's interesting that you say that's all you can think about. You don't want to be talking to me right now. You just want to play the game. That's how I feel about No Man's Sky, which is interesting because it's not the sort of game that I typically go for. It's not my flavor, but it uses a lot of the appetitive things, which I am particularly vulnerable to.
The what things?
Oh, I said appetitive.
That's a great word. What does that mean?
Appetitive is relating to or playing upon an appetite, I would think.
Okay.
You're dropped on this planet, you know, and that this is, you aren't even dropped. You wake up, your ship is crashed, you're on an alien planet, and you walk around and you're like, and you've got like a multi-tool that has like a mining laser on it, and you can see your busted ass ship. And so you're like, well, okay, I guess I better like fix this. And so you laser a rock and you get iron, and you laser a plant and you get carbon, and you're like, huh, with iron and carbon, you know, I can like fix this one little thing. So you gather these resources, you explore, and as you walk around, this is a legitimately alien world, and there's creatures wandering around, and all of these creatures are also procedurally generated by the game, so they're different on every world theoretically and every planet, and they have, the computer has evolved them to fit this particular atmosphere or this particular planet and the ecology. And so you walk around and you can take pictures of these things too with your multi-tool, and you can like upload this information and you get a little money for that. I don't know who I'm uploading it to. And see, this is my big gripe, is I'm like, who the fuck am I? Who am I sending information to? Am I trying to get home? Am I trying to get, you know, what's the deal? But even though I don't know these things that would allow me to create an experience narrative, which is my jam, I'm wandering around. And so I pick up these resources and then I'm like, oh, holy shit, I found, you know, a crystal. And if I shoot this crystal, then I get nickel. I'm like, wow, with nickel ore, I can do a lot more things. And so then you can fix up your ship. You can fly around. You meet sentient aliens, and who you can't talk to because you don't fucking understand them because you're, you know.
How do you know they're sentient?
Well, because they're wearing clothes and they go, and then you get some options for you just wanted to make me do their fake language, right?
I didn't quite get that. What was it?
I'll do it later.
Okay.
You can't force it.
I feel like a mechanic. What's that noise again that your car was making?
Right. And, you know, so obviously there is this entire race of aliens. There's big obelisks you can interact with and you learn about their history. And they have little settlements and outposts. They have science stations and landing pads for their ships. And also as you wander around, you can find like there's like knowledge stones. And so you click on one of these and you learn a word of the alien language. And so like what happens is you wander into one of these outposts and the alien looks at you and the game describes what you see. It's like, you know, this warrior, you know, is thumping his chest and pounding his multi-tool on the table. Then he looks at you and bares his teeth, and it gives you a couple of options. It's like, go away, give him your multi-tool, you know, give him plutonium, you know, but, and then he says, you know, and you don't know any of these words. And so you're like, I guess I'm gonna give him plutonium. And then, of course, you've insulted his ancestors and he beats your ass for that because you don't know what's going on. You know, this development tree thing that they engage in, where I can gather resources, use them to fix my ship, then fly the ship, and then, oh, I don't have enough inventory spaces. in my ship and in my suit. Oh, but I can buy more inventory spaces. Oh, I can buy a new ship. I can find a new ship that's been crashed and then upgrade that. And that has more spaces. And then with those extra spaces, I can get more materials and I don't have to juggle my inventory as much. But then I can find more. And then I'm like, I have gold now and I have, you know, titanium and all these things that are required for more to create more things.
How do you know that you're done with No Man's Sky?
I don't think there's a done. I think you play it until you just fucking die. I think that's the game.
Okay.
That's not true because, you know, when I do stream, you know, there's people who show up and you're right. It is a little crazy because when I was playing Fallout, I kept up this constant running banter about, you know, like how dissatisfied I was with the dialogue choices, about how this world did not make sense. Like, how can raiders and, you know, other, you know, if I've killed 5,000 raiders in this game, why are there still more raiders? You know, you know, it's just untenable in terms of civilization. I started playing No Man's Sky. And maybe it was that I was tired and I'd spent the whole day writing. But, you know, this game, the fact that all I could do was explore and take pictures of things and harvest resources and do this, it ate up so much of my brain that I could not talk. I played for hours and hours, and I think I talked for maybe 20 minutes. And so I'm walking around and I'm lasering things. And sometimes I'm like, oh, wow, look at this huge outcrop of Hebridite. I'm going to get every fucking scrap of Hebridite here. And so I spend 5 minutes lasering a rock. And eventually I come out of this fog, you know, this tunnel vision, OCD. It's very similar to where I go when I'm in my deep writing. It's the madness place where I go away and I do not experience the outside world. And I come out of that and I'm like, right, shit, I'm streaming. People are watching me on camera, and I look over at the chat and I'm like, sorry, guys, this is a new game. I'm figuring it out. It kind of eats up a lot of my brain. I'm not talking. I go, who's still here? And they're like, oh, 500 people are watching. And I'm like, 500 people are watching me laser this fucking rock at 2 a.m. on a Friday. It's a little crazy. But, you know, I joke and the people in the chat with each other. And sometimes I answer questions, you know, and so here's the thing. I keep playing this game. I love the progression of like learning this language and learning more about the culture so I can make increasingly good choices when it comes to interacting with these aliens. And then, you know, I fly up into space. And it's not like you have to do a bunch of upgrading before it lets you into space. You could probably get into space in an hour, easy. And then it's like, here's space. Oh, look, a space station. Oh, look, huge ships, asteroids. You want to shoot them. Other ships that might be aggressive. Here's other planets. There's a moon. Do you want to explore that? And you're like, you know, I've explored right now a space on this planet about the size of Stevens Point.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm in space and there's a space station with an alien and four moons and three planets I can see from here. And then it goes, press M to open the hyperspace map. And I'm like, holy, what do we mean hyperspace map? And there's all these other planetary systems that I can get to. And I'm like, what? You know, I just need more Hebridite. And so I go back down onto the planet and proceed to obsessively mine these minerals and build up my exosuit and do all these things. And everybody was laughing at me in the chat. They're like, there's so much more to do in this game, Rothfuss. I'm like, yeah, but my suit needs more slots. Otherwise, I can't carry enough Hebridite. And so like that's what this game has done for me. It's hit all of these like psychological behaviorist things where there's always a little benefit to be gained or a little puzzle to solve, just like slightly outside of my reach. So it's endless little serotonin bump carrots.
Well, it's like, what do you need to attend to anything in your real life for if you're upgrading your suit with the Hebridite?
Well, yeah, like my suit in this game is like super awesome, and it's quantifiably better than it was 3 hours ago, as opposed to like me writing my book. Like, I can sweat blood into that goddamn thing, and at the end of it, it's like, well, boy, I sure maybe did some word movings. You know, that's not satisfying.
I had a romance with Minecraft. I played a good amount of Minecraft when it was in beta. Played Minecraft. I mean, controversial opinion. I think at some point between when Minecraft was first in beta and today, Minecraft got very over-designed, and there's almost like too much going on and too many game mechanics, and it's like too crazy. And you know, there was a time in Minecraft there was no like starvation meter. Like, I think that was kind of weird. There was no pets. There wasn't any of the things that are big part pieces of the game loop for people playing today. And it was way more about Legos. Like, you would just sort of show up on the server. There were monsters and stuff, so you had to build like a shelter for night. But essentially, it was way more about just like you'd show up in this world and you'd decide what to do. And the game didn't really give you any the game didn't imply as much of a way to play, in the sense of like, you have to grow food so you don't starve, and you have to like, I don't know, there's like this whole thing with pets now where you can like get and upgrade your pets or something like that. And for me, what was fun about Minecraft was not the like this idea, the treadmill of like, there's always one problem that's right out of my grasp that I can quantifiably solve. For me, it was that I had a private server with my real life friends, and we were terraforming this world, and we were doing public works projects. We had an underground rail system, and we had a library that we built, and like, we were just like, let's see how crazy and detailed we can make this. And the bigger we built, the more resources we would need. So we would have to expand out to go get the stuff that we needed. Like, we ran out of sand, so we had to find another body of water to go mine, to set up a sand mine, and we had to build a system to transport the sand back to our main settlement.
Wow.
And that was very fun. But I think there was that element of like, we were working together, we occasionally disagreed about what the priorities were. So someone would be like, well, I need to use these rare elements for my underground mine cart system, and another person was like, I want to use them to build my sky bridge, or I want to use them to build this like, you know, this big sculpture I'm working on. And you know, we'd have to make decisions, and it became this like shared political thing of like, how well can we work together and execute this stuff. The other memory I have from Minecraft that was pretty crazy was one day we just realized how much time we were spending basically right at the spawn point, right where everyone comes into the world. And we were like, you know, it's at one point we were like, well, we've ventured out like at this point maybe like 10 or 20 miles away from our little settlement, from our town that we were making, but not like crazy out into this infinite world. And we were like, one day we were just like, I wonder how far we can go. And so we loaded up a bunch of gear, and we all were online at the same time, and we went on like a voice chat, and we picked a direction on the compass, and we just started walking, and we went for hours, and it was so epic. It was like Lord of the Rings. It was I felt like I was on mushrooms. Like, everything was so meaningful. It was like we would see these new like biomes and creatures, and we'd be like, this is amazing. I didn't know this was in the world we've put 40 hours of gameplay into.
You know, eventually I left the planet and I went and I looked at a moon. And I'm like, wow, this is super different. It looks different. There's different plants. You know, I found different minerals on the moon, although just a few. But honestly, what was, and here's the interesting thing. I went to this moon. It was legitimately different. Like, plants, you know, looked like different to the points where they were creepy. The landscape was vastly different. It was all full of like lava tubes and whatever. But like, some of the elements looked exactly the same. All of the alien outposts looked exactly the same. And the aliens were the same, and the obelisks were the same. And then I was sort of like, huh. And I was let down. And it's interesting, and I mentioned this on the stream, I'm like, it's weird that I will happily engage in this obsessive like mining behavior on this one world. And then I go to a new world and it's kind of different, like legitimately different. But I actually found myself suddenly dissatisfied with the game because it was not different enough. Whereas the thing that I'd been doing that was exactly the same, it did not dissatisfy me. And I think part of it was that I always felt like what was like beyond the horizon was going to be super unique. And until I experienced it, I got to have joy in the knowledge of it being out there. And then I went there and I'm like, oh, it's merely good. It's not great. And so I was expecting greatness and I was let down. And I bitched about it for a good long while on the stream.
This sounds like a very engaging content. It sounds like you complaining about games on the stream is probably as entertaining for people as us describing times that we played video games on a podcast.
I would say it's at least that engaging.
Skyrim had a great system that, you know, to some degree New Vegas has, and many games have done this. I thought Skyrim did a really nice job, which is throughout the world as you travel and go to these, you know, the world felt very big in Skyrim. And yeah. As you travel the world and go to all these different cities and meet people and talk with them, some people are this special class of, I mean, there's thousands of characters in this world that you can talk to, but some of them, maybe a dozen, are special characters that can become your sidekick, and you can have one sidekick at a time, and you can give the sidekick a weapon and armor and level them up and make them better and teach them spells, and like they're kind of like a second character that helps you out. And if you engage your sidekick in conversation as you travel the world with them, they will gradually sort of reveal their superhero origin story, their background story. And many of them have a quest line that you can do where it's like you learn that their family has like fallen from power and you can like restore them to their noble station or something like that. And, you know, I did all of them. I found all the companions in the game and wow. Did all of their loyalty quests. I had that was one of my favorite parts of the game. Loved it. All the companions were really cool. They all had like different specialties of fighting. You know, some of them were like bow and arrow. Some of them were sword. You know, some of them were healers, whatever. And then in the very main quest line of the game, which is the political quest line of like, are you going to support the racist terrorists or the evil empire? I went with the evil empire. And you're doing this escalating series of missions that became really repetitive of like, storm this castle, storm that castle, storm this castle for the empire. And they're just bigger and bigger battles. And eventually it became clear that it was the final mission of the quest. And it was like, storm this really big castle. And I had convinced myself, that what was about to happen, because this was I wrongly thought this was the main quest of the game, which it wasn't, but I wrongly assumed this was like the big climax and that they wanted to build that up in a more exciting way than it actually was. I thought what was going to happen is all those people throughout the world that had that I had traveled with and like completed their quests and helped them in their lives, when I had to go attack this castle, they were all going to show up and be my army. And like together, the 14 of us would like storm this castle and it would be this incredible payoff battle sequence that paid off all my narrative and emotional investments in the world. And I'd have the satisfaction of seeing my team like come together and make funny comments to each other and, you know, fight alongside each other. And of course, like none of that happened. Like it's just you attacking this castle in a really hard combat mission.
Yep.
And that was, for me, that was like heartbreaking. I was like, man, I was like, I hate when I like design the game in my head, when my head canon like surpasses what's actually available.
Yep. Yeah. And that's exactly it. Like there, I had a similar moment that the people who watch me stream still talk about, where I found, you know, I was going through Fallout and I was so angry and so disappointed. There were so many like horrendously missed opportunities in the game where they had all of these pieces of the game, you know, and if they would have arranged them in a slightly different way, it would have made for like great interactivity and great immersion and great storytelling. And so, and then I'm exploring this city and there's a giant pirate ship crashed into a skyscraper. And I'm like, what is this? I managed to find my way inside. And it's run by, it's like, it was an old, like it's a wooden pirate ship, mm-hmm. you know? And they're like, and it's been retrofitted to fly and it's being captained by a robot that's like, I don't know, like a war reenactment robot that's kind of gone off his nut. And he's like, ah, we've been marooned here for 200 years since the Great War. Can you help us? And all the bandits are trying to scavenge pieces off this thing because all of the robot's crew are still defending it. So it's a relatively pristine, piece of pre-war technology that everyone would love to scavenge. And he's like, will you help me get my ship operational again? And I'm like, oh my God, can I fly this fucking pirate ship once I get it fixed up? Can I?
Which is not that crazy to think, because that's a plot line that's more or less happened in other Fallout games.
Yes, that is absolutely a reasonable thing for me to expect, because they're like, fix the ship. And I'm like, I'll fix this ship. And they've already shown things flying. That you already have the art assets. You've already created this ship. And so I whistle my ass all over doing everything. I don't steal shit from the ship because for fear that it'll piss them off. I've got this great conversation skill. I'm pandering to this captain, doing all this stuff. I've got a huge programming skill to fuck. I'll reprogram him. I'll make him my first mate. All I wanted was to fly this goddamn pirate ship around the wasteland. It wouldn't even have to do anything. Wouldn't have to be destructive. It wouldn't have to, do whatever. But I wanted it. I wanted it so much. And finally, I completed all the quests and I did everything right. And he goes, thank you, sir. And, and the ship takes off and he flies 200 meters into a different building and crashes it there. And I'm like, some fucking chode at Bethesda was like a laughing into his fucking soy latte half calf bullshit. Like,
just to mess with you.
People thought that it would be a cool thing, but it's not a cool thing because nobody likes cool things. And somebody made like a video of my face in as I was playing it, where like you have never seen such commingled rage, disappointment, and disgust like in one human being at a moment in time. And it is you. And listen, I'm not saying that designing a game is easy. I'm not saying that these things are simple. Because there was a great message board post floating around about No Man's Sky. And somebody's like, I don't see why they just don't make it multiplayer. If they made it multiplayer, this would be brilliant. He goes, all it would need is like one guy. One guy could program that in a week to make this game multiplayer. They already have all the assets. Just let everyone log into the same whatever. And it's just laughable. This guy is like, yeah, it would take a week. You could program that, like, to say nothing of like server issues or, like he's just talking out of his ass. Now, that said, I have been on the inside working to develop games. I know a little bit about that. Oh, and you mentioned companion characters. There's a game coming out, I'm pretty sure later this year, called Numenera, where it is very story-centered. I signed on with them because they were some of the original team that created the Planescape game I mentioned earlier. And I created a companion character for their game. Did I ever tell you about that?
No.
Yeah. Yeah. I signed on to do that because, like you said, like a lot of times this is one of the most fulfilling parts of these games is your interaction with these NPCs. So I got to make one of these NPCs, I did a lot of the writing for her. I don't know exactly how it's going to play out because, I was not in charge of that game, in charge of that story. I'm hopeful. I'm very proud of that character and some of the writing I did and the concept work. And I really hope people enjoy it. But it was my first time, so I know that I didn't maybe ring the bell as hard as I would have wanted to.
All right, you ready for a big game recommendation?
Sure.
You gotta put down your No Man's Sky, and here's your next game. Have you seen Inside yet by Playdead?
No, I haven't even heard of it.
So now we're getting into my cool world of indie art games.
Oh, okay.
I mean, Inside is pretty high production indie game. But so this is my favorite game of the year. It takes about 4 hours to play. It's by the same people who did Limbo. Limbo was a pretty big hit a couple years ago. It's mechanically very simple and narratively very complicated and subtextual and leaves a lot to the imagination. It is kind of a horror game, but not in a more in a creepy way. It's supremely creepy. It's not, there's no like jump scares or things like that that are gonna like make you upset to play it. And it has probably my favorite ending of almost any video game I've ever played.
Wow.
It is a perfect gem of a game, a total work of art end to end, from every minute that you play it.
So what was it called again?
It's called Inside by Playdead. Can't recommend this game highly enough. And this is a game I would recommend to people, even if you are not a gamer and you don't play video games or you haven't played games for a long time. There's nothing in this game that will be hard, or I mean, there's going to be some puzzles where you have to like stop and think through what to do. But it's mostly, I would say, it works best as an art experience, and it's not too challenging or scary or anything like that. It is a wonderful, creepy, perfect little nugget of a game. And I'll say, Pat, I think you'd really like Overwatch. I feel like we should. I feel like here's our next stream. Let's play Overwatch together. I'll teach you how to play.
I would play it just to, just to go on and stream it and suck at it.
I really don't think so. Here's the only thing though, is there's like 20 characters and they're all sort of mechanically really different and really simple. So you can like learn one in like 5 minutes, and you will find somewhere in there will be the character that suits your play style.
And yeah, I don't doubt that. And, you know, I'm always up in some ways, and here's how I lie to myself. I'm like, I need to stay aware of what's happening in the community, you know, like because.
Oh, well, that sounds like work. I mean, we put it that way. It sounds like work.
If it's work.
You got to do that. Yeah,
I got to do it, you know. So hold on for a second. I'm buying Inside. I'm just going to add it so that I don't forget it.
Okay.
Now, see, and the reason
we got to play some Overwatch, Pat. What do I have to do to put you in an Overwatch today?
What do I have to do to sell you into this huge mechanized suit in 2 hours? you know, here's the thing, right? I will happily play some Overwatch with you. I've got a deadline today that has been, if you could see a picture of my face, you would think that I either had been sleeping on the street or had like a serious substance abuse problem. I look like I have been beat up and then shit out again. Because I'm trying to meet this deadline.
All right, here's the deal. Get your deadline done. When you're done, it's Overwatch time.
You know, see, when you're doing a lot of heroin, Max,
mm-hmm.
you don't, and your friend is like, hey, have you tried crack?
Mm-hmm.
That's, you know, two bad decisions don't get together and make like a good. It's not peanut butter and jelly.
Let me make my case. Here's my case for so Overwatch is another game that, like No Man's Sky, it has no end, right? It's these 10-minute matches or whatever it is, 15-minute matches, and you really could play it for the rest of your life. I mean, and I mean that. I mean,
not selling it, Max. You're doing the opposite.
Well,
I'm
getting there. It's a game that you will never master. There will always be people who are better than you. The strategy in the metagame will always evolve and always be lively and interesting. And it's a thing that here's the only difference is No Man's Sky. I haven't played it, but I suspect the way the game design works is it's kind of like a treadmill. The more what was it called? The Hebronium.
Mm-hmm.
Jubronium?
I made up the word, actually, so okay. I can't remember okay. what it was. Hebradium?
The more Hasidanium you get, the harder it gets to find more, right? It's like, you know, it's like any of these like mobile games. Like you never finish it, right? It's like the more resources you find, the more you need. So it's always, you're always putting in the same amount of effort to progress. Overwatch is not like that, right? It's like you grow as a player. In that way, it's actually, to me, it's closer to a sport. It's like, are you ever done playing basketball? or, you know, playing chess. No, you improve as a player against the constraints of the game, and you learn, you there's no narrative to the game other than the emergent narrative of your own struggle against the structure that the game imposes, and you learn about yourself as a person, and you learn how to do the best you can in the competitive circumstances that you find yourself in.
Boy, so no narrative element. It's like a sport. I would like to directly quote you there. It is like a sport, says Max Duncan.
I'm told that people enjoy sports.
I've heard of the sport. I've never myself personally brushed up against sport. You know,
it's when I say it doesn't have a narrative, what I mean is the game play. There is actually kind of some cool world building happening in Overwatch, but there's no story, right? You're not like going to do quests and talk to NPCs. It's not that kind of a scripted story. But this is a sort of an active area of debate in the world of game design, which is what is the more, you know, there's lots of different ideas of like what is the more valid form of story. One form of story is where, like what you did with this NPC, a writer comes in and they craft a story and it's written and you experience it. And that is almost like, I mean, I would say it's almost similar to reading a book, right? Where it's like, it's sort of this scripted thing with a finite set of possibilities and you will experience it from one end until the other. There's another form of storytelling, which is an emergent narrative that's a property of the mechanics of the game. My favorite example of this, it comes from my all-time favorite game, which is called Spelunky. Spelunky is, to me, the most perfect, beautiful game that will ever be created. And I won't get too much into it except to say it's a platformer like Mario. So you have a little guy and he's jumping around and he's trying to get through this world and survive to the end of the world. However, there's two key things that are different. The first thing is it is a roguelike. So unlike Mario, you don't have lives. When you die, you have 4 health, and when you lose your health and you die, you're over. You lose all your gear, you reset, you're back at the top of the world, and you have to go do the whole thing again. So there's permadeath every time you die. And the second thing is it's procedurally generated, meaning unlike Mario, where you can play it and learn what the level is, this is completely different every time. And there's sort of five different worlds as you play through Spelunky. But what makes it cool is you can never learn, you can't ever memorize the jumps, right? Like in Mario, there's people who can play Mario with their eyes closed because you memorize the jumps and you sort of master this game. There is no mastering Spelunky. There is only mastering yourself. And there's only learning to understand the game as a series of, it's almost like a Zen thing of like, there's only seeing the game in terms of the puzzles and possibilities in front of you and making smart risk-taking decisions of like, do I take this risk to get this resource in this situation? And it teaches a kind of discipline and self-improvement and conditional problem solving that I think about like all the time in my life. What I learned about myself from mastering Spelunky. And I'll say, like, I probably played Spelunky probably more than any other video game. And when I beat Spelunky on hell, on, like, the very difficult, like, secret ending at the end, that is one of the greatest accomplishments of my life.
Wow. Wow, that's a high recommender.
Tell me there's no story there. I mean, that is a story, right? I could tell you any individual run of Spelunky, zero part of it has been scripted. There is nothing scripted. It is randomly generated by a computer, and then you are moving your little guy through the world. It's all unique every time. But every game, you could tell your friends a gripping narrative of your experience in that world and what happened.
I talk about that, and I think about that all the time, is one of the fundamental things that humans do is create narrative. You know, so like as I'm going through No Man's Sky, you know, because they've given me nothing, and I'm like, you know, and I start joking about it. I go, well, obviously I'm the first wave of the Imperial, you know, conquerors of this, you know, rustic alien people, you know? And so I joke about that for a while. I go, oh, no, wait, I can take pictures of different plants and animals. Obviously I'm playing Pokemon Go. You know, I'm an ecotourist, you know, and so I create my own narrative because effectively there's a narrative vacuum there. So I do absolutely know what you're talking about, and I have played games like that as well. It's interesting. A lot of what you talked about there, I worked on a game called or I am currently, and I have worked on a game called Heroes Song. That is going to launch. Gosh, is it just in a couple of months? Where they brought me in. I was wrong about how much writing time it would take to write this NPC, because writing dialogue trees of any complexity is such a different skill. So John Smedley, who used to run Sony Online, and we've bumped into each other in various places, he contacted me and he's like, I'm starting my own company. I want to do this game. It's the game I've always wanted to write. He goes, I need somebody to help me do world creation so everything feels cohesive and fits together in the right way. And I'm like, I can't write. He goes, you don't write anything. He goes, you don't write anything. I just pick your brain, Skype calls. We talk about the world. You give me your opinion and then you go on your merry way. And I'm like, oh, I shouldn't. And then he offered to cut my charity in on a piece of the action, which is really the key to my heart. You include world builders in something. So we worked on that, and that was a great experience, because you know the world that's created and the gameplay should be like inextricably interwoven. You know, like honestly, trying to tell a great character story, you know, in No Man's Sky, I don't know if that's the right place for it. You don't want to have interactions with a bunch of NPCs because they're going to be scattered all over the galaxy. That's not the right place for an ensemble cast. But for this Heroes Song game, you know, we got to talk a lot about, you know, what is the world like? What is the world for? Where there, it is a procedurally generated world. We seem to be using this phrase an awful lot. But what's different is you get to choose the pantheon for your world. There's these gods, and then you pick this god, and how important is he, and this god, and how important is she? And based on what gods you pick, like maybe you pick no elven gods, and so it generates this world, and you sign up partway through its history. You join the game partway through its history. Maybe without any gods, the elves just died off real early. And so in that world, there are no elves. It's not a playable race, and you can't run into them if you're playing somebody else. Maybe there's just elven ruins in this world. But here's what happens. You can play through this world. There is also a narrative arc, you know, in addition to playing the game. And then it's iterative. Once you effectively solve this world, and that's part of this overall experience with the world, is, you know, you reset and recreate the universe, but depending on what you do, your actions can affect the nature of the gods, and you can discover new gods, and your character, if you play the game in the right way, can become a new god for when the world is recreated. And so then you're like, you can, you know, your previous player who is now one of these deities gets entered in, or maybe you discover this, you know, this god that was locked away, that god, you know, and as you're playing the game, your character unearths this, and then that god becomes a god you can plug into a pantheon. And so it's, you know, I will say, if we manage to pull off half the things we're trying to do in this game, it will be amazing, because there's stuff that we're building into it that I've just never even known to exist in a game, even conceptually. I'm excited to have that launch, for no other reason than I think it will be fun to play, because I didn't write it, I didn't code it, so that one will be a huge surprise to me as I play through it.
Can I read you one of my favorite game things?
Sure.
So this is by a game philosopher who I absolutely love. I mean, he is like my guy in philosophy of games and game design in general. His name is Bernie DeKoven, and he writes, he's sort of very famous for being a founding member of this thing called the New Games Movement, which was kind of like a hippie play games movement in the 60s. And he has a very famous and influential essay in the New Games book. And more pertinent to this conversation, he has a newer book called The Well-Played Game. And he gives some really good definitions of these terms, which is like a big problem when you're talking about what is a game, what is play, what is fun. Like, those are really squishy, difficult terms to pin down and define. And I think he gives very good definitions. So I'm going to skip over some of those, but I'll start with, so his definitions, and this is for his book, The Well-Played Game. So he defines playing games. He says, even though we're involved in a game, we're not always playing. Sometimes we're negotiating, sometimes arguing, sometimes struggling for real. Even though we're playing, we are not always involved in a game. Sometimes we have no goal at all. Sometimes we're merely fascinated, sometimes silly, sometimes chaotic. Playing a game is a special condition of both play and games. The game we're playing is the script as we have chosen to enact it. He defines well, meaning the phrase well and the phrase well-played game. The word well embraces the qualities of what we consider to be a state of excellence and health. Knowing that something is done well is an appreciation of the excellence of the deed as well as the excellence of the doer. The fact that we use the word well also to indicate a state of excellent health, that we can feel well, only enhances the wholeness that this word describes. Playing well. When we're playing well, we are at our best. We are fully engaged, totally present, and yet at the same time, we are only playing. And then finally, his definition of the well-played game. The well-played game is a game that becomes excellent because of the way it's being played. That's, to me, that's what I'm looking for in a game.
Interesting.
A game that becomes excellent because of the way it's being played. I'm only human. I enjoy playing a game like Skyrim or Fallout, where those games, I think they do not become excellent because of the way that they're being played. But for me, where I can really get meaning from my life and have an artistic experience with a game, and what I'm having right now with Overwatch, is the idea that I didn't just play Overwatch, I played Overwatch well. Even if I lost, I'm capable. People are so sportsmanlike on Overwatch. Even if your team loses, everyone takes the time to congratulate the other team and they say, well played, that was a well played game. All right, I have one last question for this episode. Are you watching the Olympics?
On the TV, no.
In your imagination, though.
I silvered in No Man's Sky Hebrium Gathering. In my imagination, actually, I don't have like cable or access to conventional television. Most of what I watch is movies or stuff on DVD. So I haven't watched it except for like when I've been in a bar at Gen Con and there was, I assume, volleyball happening. I've seen little bits and pieces here and there, but that's about it.
We're in like full Olympics craziness right now, and nothing could be more boring to me. For all I just said about like the well-played game and sportsmanship and all of this bullshit, I'm just exquisitely, fascinatingly bored by the Olympics.
You know, for me, I stay away from the Olympics purposefully because I talked about this on Twitter where I said, I just can't watch it for the most part because I know these people, the entire focus of their life has been developing their skill and craft and physicality to the point where they can compete in this event, this pinnacle event. And the stakes are too high for me because, you know, it's like, yeah, it's great that this one person strove against adversity and here he is on the pedestal and yay, gold medal. I can't think about that because here are all these other people, the representatives of their nations, these people who are goddamn superhuman by any metric. Like, you know, like whatever it is that we are, Max, they are the other thing, you know, where, you know, they like these gymnasts I look at and I'm like, you put like just a Harlequin mask on you and you are, you know, you are a superhero. That's all it would take.
There's something to that of like how sad it is for the people who have given their life to this thing and they don't win.
And that's my point is like, I can't watch it because I feel crushing empathy for everyone else in these games, it's just, it shatters me. I can't interact with it.
For me, there's like something I can't get over. It's like there's something so funny about the how contingent this all of this stuff is. It's like, well, it's like the, all this pomp and procedure and ceremony, and it's like, now we will find out which guy of all of the guys is the best at throwing the stick. Let's watch. And it's like, and then I saw this article where it's like the one where they throw the stick, it was like people got too good at throwing the stick and they didn't want them to be that good, so they changed the stick so it was harder to throw, and then no one's thrown it that far since they changed it, but people still give their whole lives to throwing the stick within these stupid regulations. And it's like, that's the thing. It's like, I don't know, it's like, it's not, I guess it's no more or less like arbitrary and contingent than anything that we do with our lives, but that's depressing to think about. I don't want to think about that.
You actually just described Overwatch, Max.
No, that's real. That's important.
Okay.
I just want to say that my 3-to-1 K-to-D ratio with D.Va is, that's an achievement. All right, change that fucking stick.
Okay, so what's interesting is, so here, somewhat justifying the existence of Twitter, right? I went on Twitter, and because everyone's talking about the Olympics, and I just said, I can't watch the Olympics. I can't stand to watch people who have trained their whole lives be judged on a single performance. And, you know, that's really the issue for me, is you can be all of these things and you're doing this thing, and it's, and they do this thing that is miraculous, that like 8 human beings in the world can do. And the judges go, ooh, you see, her foot was a little turned to the side. That's going to cost your points. And I'm like, what the fuck? And so I said this, and then somebody jumps on, and his name's David Plummer. And I mentioned that just because this is public record. Normally I don't mention people's names, but he's actually an Olympic swimmer who follows me on Twitter, which was kind of a baffler, but cool. And so I said this about the Olympics, and he comes in and he says, an athlete must judge him or herself. The world may judge us based on our single performance, but we know better. The road we take will teach us more than our performance ever will. And if we get to the end and we are happy with our decisions, then it has been worth it regardless of the outcome. And I'm like, wow. Like, that's always what I would hope. You know, I hope that everyone who gets to the Olympics is like, I am awesome.
You're saying it's the well-played game.
That's exactly what he's saying. He's saying that all of this has effectively, it shaped and informed his life. And, you know, it's honestly, it's what I tell people about writing. I say, if you write to be published, if you write to make money, if you write to be famous, you're creating expectations that you have no control over. And therefore, if those expectations are defeated, you will be unhappy. And that's not a good strategy if your goal in life is to be happy and satisfied. You know, if you write instead for the joy of it in your heart and the act of creation, then you win, you know, and then if you write a book and then you've enjoyed it, you win and you are satisfied and content and happy. And then if a person reads it on top of that, then that's gravy. That's like a bonus. And he seems to be saying something similar here, you know, and we actually chatted back and forth a little bit. And I said, I told him the truth. I go, that's really nice to hear from the perspective of someone in the games. And it's something I've always hoped it was true. He goes, it ruins me when I see people who have trained to this superhuman skill and then they put their foot wrong and then heartbreak. And he goes, it's true. And the heartbreak can be real, but the joy is real as well. And being able to compete should bring joy to us all. And so like, it was super cool to hear that coming from somebody doing it, like, and not doing it a little. It's like, oh, I swam in college. This dude is at the Olympics right now. And that was so neat. This was Twitter actually bringing me a very unique experience and information that I could not have been exposed to otherwise.
Yeah, but what's his competitive rank in Overwatch?
Ooga jack not loose. Ooga jack up, fat thing, dirty.